I may pop up a disclaimer at the top that I'm, you know, I'm turning this around real quick and I'm not going through and editing out any swears or anything. And so I'll just check the box for this one for explicit and it'll be fine.
David swears a lot. I can't help it. The world sucks.
Yeah. Well, and some of the highlights in this book were the fluent use of profanity. So,
yeah.
Hey, everybody. This is just a bonus episode where I'm kind of catching up with somebody that I've previously had on the podcast. This time it's David Agronoff. Hi, David.
Hey, Seth. It's very good to be here.
Yeah. Since last time I had you on, we've met in person. So real life friends now.
So. Yeah. Well, we podcasted so many times, so it was cool, getting breakfast in Portland. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was excellent.
I enjoyed that. And, you know, Hugo's There and Take Me to Your Reader are two of my favorite podcasts. So I always enjoy collaborating.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so for this episode, you had reached out to me at some point, I think maybe when we were at breakfast and telling me about a book that you had that was going to be coming out. And you have sent me books in the past. And I am so jealous of my leisure reading time that, you know, I always give it a solid, I'll try. I'll see if I can work it. Yeah. Right. And so anybody who's out there who's like, I should send Seth a book. No, you shouldn't send Seth a book because he probably won't read it. And even if he likes you very much.
And I totally get that because, you know, I do lots of reading for the podcast as well. And there's certainly times where people offer me books or I'm like, especially when people want to send me fantasy books. And I'm just like, I'm not your reader. You know, because I did read a lot of fantasy when I was a kid, but I'm not a big fantasy reader. So,
And I get a lot of solicitations through email, you know, saying, hey, I think this person would be perfect for your podcast. And I'm like, you haven't listened to my podcast then.
Right.
Well, because I don't really do that. Right.
Right. Well, and it's like the new marketing that authors get from AI. That's like, obviously AI, where it's like, you've written this fantastic novel and it's like, great, your AI skimmed my book, but
right. Yeah.
I recently
go ahead, David.
Well, I recently got one for an anthology that I'm in, and I got it because alphabetically I'm the first author alphabetically in the novel. And so the AI accidentally talked to me about how great, you know, how I redefined, you know, how horror is looked upon in the modern era and, you know, all this like wonderful stuff for an anthology that I have one story in. It's funny because even the editors didn't get that like bullshit marketing email, but I did. And that book, by the way, is Dread Coast. It's a all Southern California horror writers anthology, and I have a story in it, and it benefits victims of the Palisades fires. So if you're looking for Southern California themed horror fiction, anybody, Dread Coast is the name of the book. And I have a very Stanislaw Lem like cosmic horror story in there called To Speak in Silver Linings. So
cool.
I have the only sci-fi horror story in the collection, I think.
Okay. But nice. Yeah. You know, and so most of the time, if I'm talking to an author, it's somebody that I've reached out to, you know, because I came across their work and want to highlight it. Right. And those don't always work out. People don't always respond.
Yeah.
But in this case, when you were telling me about the pitch for this book, I thought, okay, that's really interesting. And then when I saw the cover and saw just a couple of the promotional things about it, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm going to enjoy this. And so I will rip the Band-Aid off and say, I really enjoyed this one, David. I thought it was great. So why don't you tell people about the book?
Yeah. So the book is called Great America in Dead World. And it is a radical science fiction philosophical experiment. So if you're talking about the novel just in a purely what the story is, that's kind of what it is. But when I say it's an experimental novel, the way that I wrote it was kind of an experimental thing. I've written, this is my 11th novel, right? And so for anyone who doesn't know my work, most of my published work is horror, and probably definitely my top selling book of all time is The Last Night to Kill Nazis, which came out from Clash Books, which is available nationally at Barnes & Noble. And it's sold well enough that I've actually already written the sequel. And we haven't set a date yet for the sequel. But And Last Night to Kill Nazis is a World War II vampire novel. It's about a Jewish commando and a vampire on the last night of World War II trying to kill as many Nazis as possible before the surrender.
As one does.
And so I say this to say that I haven't really written a novel like this, like Great America and Dead World before. I've written lots of novels. And Last Night to Kill Nazis, you know, is an action adventure novel for the most part with, and then, you know, like some of my other horror novels are like Punk Rock Ghost Story. And, you know, I write a lot of environmentally themed, I have written a lot of science fiction, short fiction, and I did write a science fiction action novel a couple of years ago called Goddamn Killing Machines, which I kind of pitch as PKD meets, like The Dirty Dozen. Right. And, so I've written science fiction before, but and this is a very long way of getting around to what the experiment is. But about 6 years ago, one of my writing partners, Anthony Trevino, and my buddy Larry and I started the Dickheads podcast. And that's where most people know me from. And I've been on Hugo's there twice before. We covered Way Station and The Dispossessed. And so if anybody heard those episodes, they know that I am a complete and total nerd for the history of science fiction. But my two favorite authors are John Bruner and Philip K. Dick, for sure. And by doing the Dickheads podcast, we started reviewing all of Phil's work in publication order. And so we would do these deep dives on the novels. So I was investing myself very heavily in the novels. But along the way, I ended up going to the archive at Fullerton and found a bunch of his unfinished treatments and outlines and novels he started and didn't finish. And so I started researching a nonfiction book, which I'm still working on, although I have three completed drafts of it already, called Unfinished PKD. And one of the things that I discovered when I was doing Unfinished PKD was that sometime around 1965, Phil wrote a letter to another science fiction writer named Ron Goulart. And if people don't know Ron Goulart, Seth, you would love Ron Goulart.
Okay.
Because Ron Goulart's science fiction is very funny. It's very Robert Sheckley, very Douglas Adams. But he was a fellow Berkeley writer. And around 1965, he asked Phil, he said, "Hey, would you like to get together for a coffee or a drink? Because I'm about to start writing my first novel and I'd really like to get some advice." And Phil said, "Well, my car will only go to my psychiatrist and my phone is tapped. So I'd like to write you a letter." And he wrote, in 1965, he wrote a 5-page letter outlining his formula for writing a novel. Now, here's the thing about the formula letter. Before Phil wrote the letter to Ron Goulart, he never wrote the formula down. He never put it on paper before. So it was completely intuitive. And guess what? He never thought about it again. He never thought about the letter again. And one of the funny things is that the letter is mentioned in Phil's biography from the early 90s, Divine Invasions, written by Lawrence Sutton. But it's just kind of briefly mentioned, like, oh yeah, he wrote this letter to Ron Goulart, but nobody really thought much of it. It was just like, oh, like he wrote this letter telling him, you know, there's like one quote from the letter, but it wasn't thought of much. And then a few years ago when Ron Goulart was actually, he knew he was dying, he was sick, and he started selling off some of his memorabilia to benefit his kids, his adult children. And one of the things he sold was that formula letter. He sold it to my buddy, Randall Radin. And so next thing you know, we have it, we have the formula letter. Mm-hmm. And so Randall put it out there for all of us to see. And so what I did was, because I was working on Unfinished PKD and I had a chapter on how Philip K. Dick writes a novel. And there's, it's really interesting because he didn't write every novel the same, you know, like Stephen King is universally kind of known as being a seat of the pantser, right? Mm-hmm. Like religiously, in fact, almost obnoxiously so. And that for those of us who are outliners and I am. And so, but Phil sometimes wrote from the seat of his pants, like Man in the High Castle. And sometimes he outlined like Ubik. And sometimes he ignored the outline or used only a little bit of the outline, or sometimes he stuck to it religiously. Sometimes he threw it out. So, but what he did do was intuitively use this formula. And when I got the letter, the first thing I did was I said, okay, well, I've already written this chapter about how he writes a novel. Now I got to rewrite the whole chapter because I know more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the first thing I did was I murder boarded 30 of the novels using the formula. So I came up with like five criterias that he mentioned in it, like the antagonist, the protagonist, antagonist, the three levels, the three themes, blah, 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 whatever. Anyways, like, and I made a list and then I just pulled all the novels off my shelf. And then I would just look at it long enough to be like, okay, here's where he did this. Here's where he did that. And then I typed it out and made a list of 30 of the novels. Like, here's how he used the formula. Mm. And it's interesting because it was intuitive, sometimes he'd flip things. Like Ubik, he introduces the characters opposite from how he said he would in the formula, right? Like the character that he said he would always introduce first is introduced second, and they swap it, but it's still the formula, right? He's still using it. He's just kind of tweaking it a little bit here and there. And really the first novel that he started using the formula was his second novel, the second science fiction novel, The World Jones Made. And it's really after that where he started using it. Now there's a couple like Dr. Blood Money in the 60s that he doesn't use the formula at all. He's got too many characters. It's just, it doesn't work that way. But for the most part, like I've become obnoxious because whenever people talk about certain PKD novels, then I'll go, oh, see, that's the formula there. He's using it here and he's using it there. And so a funny story about, well, and so Great American Dead World, I've talked a long time around this, but the concept of Great America and Dead World was I had taught a class on the formula online and or taught a week of a class, an online class where I was the featured guest talking about the formula. And there's another funny story about Tim Powers and that. I had taught this class and my co-host on the podcast, D. Harlan Wilson, said to me, and he was just kidding around, and he said, well, what good is teaching the formula if you don't use it?
Right.
And then I thought, well, I should use it. Maybe I should write a novel using the formula. But then I took it one step further because I was like, well, if I'm going to take the step of writing a novel in the formula, and I've immersed myself in his work for 6 years for the podcast and writing Unfinished PKD, and I've been reading his outlines and his letters, and nobody knows him. Well, I shouldn't say nobody knows him better than me, but I would say nobody knows him better than me who is a writer who's also an expert in the formula. I was in this unique position. And so the experiment became that I was going to method act as Philip K. Dick. And I was going to imagine myself, my favorite era of Philip K. Dick is 1963-64, that era. He wrote my favorite of his novels during that era, like Martian Time Slip and like Three Stigmata, Palmer Eldridge and all that. So I pictured, okay, 1963, Philip K. Dick is transported through time to 2023. That's when I was writing it. And he spends 6 months in our world. So he sees MAGA and climate change and social media and AI. And how does he comment on it? And so when I sat down to outline the novel, I took the themes that Philip K. Dick liked to write about, like what is human, what is real. And I tried to, to hit all the notes, right? Like all the different things that he thought about. And then I tried to think about, you know, well, how would he talk about climate change? How would he talk about social media? And then I looked at the formula, like how he formatted these things. And then I started outlining the story based on the formula. And the thing that I was, one of the things I was really proud of was that one of the last things he says in the formula letter is he said, this isn't how to write a novel. This is how I get 55,000 words, the requisite amount out of the typewriter. Mm-hmm. And when I finished the novel, it was 56,000 words and like it kind of, you know, fit in the mold. And so the cool experiment or the thing about it was to write a novel as Phil. And I will tell you, Seth, that multiple times, and I can give specific examples if you want, but there are multiple times where I was certainly writing a novel that I would never in a million years write, right? David Agronoff right. would not write Great America and Dead World. This is not a novel I would write normally. There are things in it that are so Phil, that are so not me, that, and my system is that whenever I sit down to write, I edit yesterday's work to warm up. Mm. And there are certainly a couple times where I laughed out loud because I was like, holy shit, this is so Philip K. Dick. It is so not me. And, but there's definitely a few times where David slips in, you know, and, right. Specifically when somebody described as an asshole's idea of a fuck face.
I wrote that down. I was like, that sounds like David.
Yeah, that was definitely me like typing that sentence and being like, you know what? I'm going to leave that there. Phil would not write that.
Yeah.
There are times where I feel like it's a little bit more on the nose politically than Phil sometimes was. But
if there was ever a time to be on the nose politically, it's now.
Right, right. And, you know, the novel took on a different significance when Trump won, right. Because I was hoping that this was going to be like an experiment in like seeing how bad things could get. And we avoided it. Unfortunately, it took on a different tenor. You know, in this novel, like Keith, my editor at Choir, I originally pitched this idea to Keith. He was here to be on a panel about Philip K. Dick at Comic-Con, and we went for a walk on the beach, which is kind of funny. Sunset at the beach. And I just told him, I was like, well, the next novel, I'm starting a novel like in a week. I told him, like, I'm starting this novel in a week, and this is what I'm doing. And Keith was like, well, if you need a publisher, I want to be the one to do it. And since Keith is a serious dickhead, he became the right person to do it. And
nice.
You know, and that was cool. And, you know, and you know, it's funny because I had two examples of people calling bullshit on the formula, right? Including one, which I mentioned, and there's an essay in the back, and people should know too that I put an essay in the back that kind of tells how I did this, how I wrote this, because I understand the hubris in this. My buddy Cody Goodfellow, who's a really talented author here in San Diego, when I first told him that I wanted to do this, his first reaction was, who the fuck are you? You know, who do you think you are to do this? And I, you know, I told him, like, I've put in the work. I think I'm the person to do this, but I am fully prepared that I realize there are many people who will say, this dyslexic guy in San Diego is not the dude to write a novel in Philip K. Dick's voice. And I will say that the greatest compliment that I got so far, the best review I've gotten, there's a guy who's been researching Philip K. Dick since the 80s, and he's the author of a book called The Pink Beam, The Philip K. Dick Companion. And he goes by the moniker Lord Running Clam. I had him on my podcast to talk about the book. And LRC is, you couldn't be more of an expert than of Philip K. Dick. Basically, he's the guy that I can make deep, deep cut jokes and he gets them, right? And LRC basically telling me that it was like reading a lost Philip K. Dick novel was like, it almost broke me, right? Because he was the one person that I was like, if I can win over LRC, I will feel comfortable with anybody else who does hate it. And
yeah,
certainly some people will hate it. You can't please everyone.
Right.
And I, you know, I'm sure there will be somebody that will be like, you know, fuck that guy.
I'm swearing a lot today.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there will always be people who, like, based on the hubris of it, right, who would be just like, well, who is this guy? Therefore, he can't have done it, so I'm not going to read it.
Right. And, you know, that's certainly, I understand. If somebody told me they were going to write a lost John Bruner novel, I'd be like, you're crazy. And, you know, there's a reason why it doesn't say any of that stuff on the cover, right? Because in the end, the novel has to stand on its own. It has to be its own thing. However, good habits, bad habits that PKD had, like, there's certain things that I think Phil had certain bad habits as a writer. And I actually tried to mimic those. And, for like one thing, like Phil's last science fiction novel he wrote in 1981 was called The Divine Invasion. And The Divine Invasion could have been written in the 60s, right? Mm. Like, he made no attempt to update the technology. And so one of the weird things for me in writing Great American Dead World is I updated a lot of the technology because I wanted to picture him being here and seeing the stuff. But it's also antiquated in a lot of ways, because in a lot of ways, some of the ways I'm writing about AI and simulations and things like that are kind of outmoded and out of date on purpose. Because that's like a thing that I don't think Phil fully would understand things. And there were definitely times where Keith, when we were editing the book, where he wanted to update some piece of technology. And I'm like, I don't know. I think that's how Phil would have understood it. Which is, you know, kind of a funny thing, but,
yeah. You know, the book does look forward, right? Because it's kind of extrapolating, simulation and not really consciousness upload, but almost, you know, Matrix style jacking into a simulation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, we can get into the plot in a little bit, and how it relates to PKD themes, but like, you know, it's the experiment of doing the formula can only go so far as you have to have a story that makes sense or that, you know, is doing, you know, is carrying those themes forward. And for me, the story had to do a couple things. It had to play with the questions of what is human, what is reality. And it had to look at the modern world and you know, and through those lens, it had to like kind of ask deep philosophical questions, because Phil was more of a surreal philosopher than he was a science fiction writer, to be honest. And that was reflected in the way he reacted to certain things that the editors would do when he turned in Martian Time Slip. Don Wolheim rejected the novel at first, saying, because there was a Martian colony a colony on Mars in 1994. And he said, Phil, there's no way we're going to have a colony on Mars by 1994. And he's like, let's make it 2094. And Phil refused. And basically his argument was, well, in my 1994, we're on Mars. And we made it. And if that's the thing is like, and there are certain people who like have grandiose ideas of where Phil was seeing other universes and all that stuff. I'm not that guy. I see him as a writer, but
you don't see him as the guy sitting on the bench at the end of The Man in the High Castle, kind of seeing through the veil.
No, but interesting enough, Seth, I sat on that bench a couple weeks ago.
Oh, awesome.
When we went on the tour of the Bay Area a couple weeks ago, all the dickheads gathered. We went to Portsmouth Square, where that scene takes place, and David Gill did a reading from the novel. And so I have a picture up of me holding Man in the High Castle sitting on the Tagomi bench.
Nice.
And so it's interesting that you bring up that scene. And that was, to me, one of the coolest moments of the whole weekend, was sitting on the Tagomi bench. And we took a robot cab to get there. So we took Johnny Cab to get there.
Cool. I think you mean an auto.
An auto. Phil would have called it an auto. You're right. Yes. And it's funny because and you know what's weird, Seth? And I think you'll appreciate this. When we were walking around Chinatown after we sat on the Tagomi bench, there was only one other guy in the group who was like quoting Big Trouble in Little China with me, and I was horrified that no one else in the group was like as excited about being in the neighborhood that Big Trouble in Little China took place in. And I was like, what's wrong with you nerds? That is one of the coolest parts, but
I would have let you down if I would have been with you. Cause I have only seen that movie once, and it was last year.
So. Well, at least you saw it last year, but I'm a big John Carpenter guy. So Big Trouble was a big deal. So, but anyways, no, I don't see Phil as the guy seeing all the other universes. Some people do. And I don't begrudge them for their belief. I'm not the guy that likes Phil because he was a mystic or he saw things. I like him as a writer. So I'm purely on that track, and so it's fun because, you know, still the formula is known by like researchers and things like that. And we talk about the formula a lot now. Not to toot my own horn too much. And I'll take a lot of credit for being the one to really explore and, you know, cause I have a whole PowerPoint on the formula. And one of the things that I did in this PowerPoint was I actually took unwritten out, because one of the things I did in Unfinished, and one of the reasons why I was the person to do this, is because in Unfinished, I would take every time I read one of his outlines, because he didn't outline in the formula, but you could see how the ideas would translate to the formula. And you could be like, okay, this character would do this, and this character would do that. And then it would be. And so like one of the parts of the class that I teach about the formula, we take, he did four total outlines for Owl in the Daylight, which would have been his next novel when he died. It would have been the next science fiction novel. And he chased four different concepts for Owl in the Daylight. And so the third concept, which I call Peaceland, he wrote a 2-page letter explaining a potential idea for it to his agent. And so I take that 2-page letter and I like translate it through the formula and I outline it basically like, this is how Phil would have written it if he had actually sat down to write the novel. And I feel very confident that my outline reflects how he would have written that novel. Now, he didn't write that novel. And by the time he died, he had moved on to another concept, which was even a cooler concept, for Owl in the Daylight. And unfortunately we never got it because he died. And one of the things that's sad about that too, is that because his last novel wasn't a science fiction novel, a lot of people had this wrong assumption that Phil was going in a path where he wasn't going to be writing science fiction anymore, but his next planned novel would have been a science fiction masterpiece, really, Owl in the Daylight. Because the whole novel is about an alien who's never heard sound before, who comes to Earth and discovers music. And it was super awesome concept. And we never got it. And it would have been great. But and that was the whole thing, is teaching the formula was like, you know, to a bunch of dickheads who were very hostile to the idea, you know, one in particular.
Let's hear this one.
Yeah. So, a writer we're both fans of, you're a big fan of Tim Powers, right? Like,
recently. Yeah. I've only read a couple of his, but I've enjoyed both of them.
Okay. Yeah. So Tim was an acolyte of Phil's because, and actually when Phil moved to Orange County, Tim was one of the two people that picked him up from the airport. It was Tim Powers and my friend Linda Castellini, who picked him up from the airport. Linda's been on our podcast. She's awesome. And they picked him up at the airport. And so Tim's known him that long. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was rededicated to him. The original dedication was not Tim, but it was amended in the later editions. So, you know, he and Phil go back. He picked Phil up from after he had himself committed one time. That's how well Tim knows him. And Tim, unfortunately, had never heard of the Ron Goulart letter. And so on Tuesday nights, we do this hangout where all the Dick scholars all get together online. Anybody can join us. We do it every Tuesday. So if you follow me online, you can find details of it. In the first hour, we usually have a guest where we interview somebody about a book or a paper or a project that they're working on. You're going to have to come on sometime and promote your podcast, Seth. I really love that. But I know you're not a big PKD guy, but I think people would love to hear about your journey. But anyways, we do this every Tuesday, and it was a outgrowth of, we used to have it for a little while. David Gill taught a class on Tuesday nights, where all the PKD people came together, and we had like 50 people would show up for these classes. And I was going to be teaching the formula the next week, the next Tuesday. And when David Gill said, and Tim was a regular in the class, he comes sometimes to the hangout. He's been to the hangout a couple times. Tim happened to be there that night. And when they previewed the formula, Tim said, when I said, oh, Gill said, next week, David Agronoff will be teaching the Philip K. Dick formula. And Tim went, what? There's no Philip K. Dick formula? That's crazy. And we all started laughing. And then I said, well, Tim, have you ever heard of this letter that he wrote Ron Goulart? And he was like, no. And I said, well, you better come back next week because we're going to have a lot to tell you. And Tim said some very nice things to me after I taught the formula class. And I actually got a really nice email from him that said that I'm going to change the way that we study Philip K. Dick forever.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And that was, I want to frame that email. I got to print it out and frame it. It was pretty cool. And so that was cool that Tim said that, and he came around, and believe me, I was grinning from ear to ear when he started, when he called bullshit on it, because, like, you know, I love to prove this stuff wrong. And then, you know, and then that was, I had already written Great America, but I hadn't released it yet. And so I also had that in my back pocket. You know, hey, it's out now. And one of the cool things is that I think people are enjoying the experiment. They're picking up the things, you know, and, but I'm excited to hear, cause I haven't really talked to you since you read it. And, I'm glad to hear that you liked it. You read it partially on the way to Worldcon, right?
Or yeah, I had it with me on the way to Worldcon. Unfortunately I took the train up and I fell asleep. And so I didn't get much reading done on that, cause I got on the 6:45 AM train.
Oh yeah.
It was interesting reading your afterword in there, because you mentioned, you're like, hey, if you can't get through it, if you just read the essay at the back, you know, that'll give you some talking points and it'll spoil a couple of things. I don't feel it spoils as much as you think. Other than to kind of show how everything lines up, and one particular thing I actually had to go back and wait, what happened there? I had to reread and I'm like, oh, I see what's going on there. And then in the afterword, in the essay, you kind of make that a little more explicit. I'm like, oh, okay, that's really smart. And I don't know how much you want to talk about that thing.
Well, we can talk about it. I think let's first go into the plot, and then we'll get into those things. And so for people, if you're not sold yet that you want to check out this experiment, and believe me, this is an indie book, so every purchase that people do out there, and if you get it, enjoy it, please spread the word, because this is all word of mouth. I have had national books released, but this is a labor of love and an indie release. So the plot is that there's a character named Kai Dame, and Kai, one of the things about the Philip K. Dick formula is that there's always a subhuman character in the beginning. And what he means by subhuman is somebody who's put upon, who's broke, who doesn't have money, is the lowest echelon of poor. And if you look in the Philip K. Dick novels, you'll see it all the time. Like Ubik has a character who's just so broke he can't pay to open his door. You know, Rick Deckard is so poor he can't get a real animal, and so he doesn't want to go out and kill replicants or Andes in the novel. But he needs to kill five to get the money so he can get a real animal, right? And like Galactic Pot Healer, the main character is all he wants to do is fix pots, but no one will hire him to do it. And he doesn't have the money to stop the ads in his dreams. And, you know, so I could go through 100 of these Philip K. Dick novels. They all start with that. And so my character is, a post-human person who, in order to survive climate change, has adapted to be partially robotic. And any person that's more than 50% mechanical in this world is not considered a full human being. They're considered P50, and that means, you know, they're not, you know, they're 50% machine. And many people, in order to survive in this climate change apocalypse, have resorted to these technological enhancements. And Kai is one of those people. And her job is to continue the biological functions of the rich upper class people who live mostly in online simulations, and their physical bodies have to be maintained by someone who can change their foodal tubes, because the only food that grows in this future is this disgusting paste made of Amaroth and taro that they call foodal. And see, these are all things that, like, foodal is a very Philip K. Dick concept. He would, and so the point is Kai wants to live in the simulation like everyone else. And the ultimate simulation, the gold level plan, is this thing called Heaven for the Living, where you give up your body and you upload your mind to this pure heaven simulation. And if the entire families go together, they can live in one simulation together. And that's considered like heaven gold plus, the ultimate, creation of President Supreme, the one true leader of this future America. And so part of the Philip K. Dick formula is you always have a powerful character who gets introduced, like in the second chapter or second to the first person. It doesn't always happen in the second chapter. Sometimes it's fourth chapter or whatever, but second, and the powerful character in this one is the chief of staff of the White House, a character named Roger Greenstone. They always have to have two syllable names. I don't know why Phil just insisted that everyone who's powerful has two syllables in their name. And in fact, in the outline for Ubik, he had a character who was originally supposed to be a powerful character named Joe Chippenfield. And then he switched that character to be the subhuman character, and he shortened their name to Joe Chip in the final novel. So the character's name in the final novel is Joe Chip. But in all the outlines, he was Chippenfield. He's that committed to the two-syllable, one-syllable thing. This is the level of nerdity that I've got here, Seth. So this is why I could do this. And and what always happens in the formula is that the subhuman character and the powerful character, who either works for the government or works for a corporation, their storylines have to come together at some point and fuse the personal issues, the personal problems of the characters, and the world global issues of the science fiction novel, like whether it's an alien invasion or replicants on Earth or whatever it is. And in this case, the chief of staff of the White House needs Kai, who's working for his father-in-law, to convince him to upload his body. But he's a former philosophy professor and doesn't want to give up his body and doesn't want to go fully simulated. And that's where the two storylines basically come together. And then we also have a lot of stuff about, you know, what's going on politically in Great America in the future. And but that's the basics of the plot. And that's how it all figures in. And if you look at it, and the idea was that you have questions of what is human, what is real, what is, you know, about the politics and the way Phil would do. And then the whole philosophy, the whole thing with like Kai having to convince this philosophy professor to give up his body is where you get into the weeds of a lot of the philosophical things of what it means to be real and human as a part of the novel. And then we come to lots of weird and different questions about, or answers towards the end of the novel about those issues. But I will say, these are some of the things that caught or were parts that were so Philip K. Dick that are not David Agronoff type things, right? I would never write a novel where a huge plot point hinges on a character making a joke about Ludwig Binswanger and Martin Heidegger, existential philosophers from Europe who I didn't even know existed before I started studying Philip K. Dick. But Philip K. Dick would. He would have that be a plot point, because one of the most, you know, there's a scene where the Nick, the philosophy professor, basically realizes that he can't simulate, that the AI can't simulate his dead wife because he makes a joke about Martin Heidegger, who was a German philosophy professor or thinker, philosopher. He makes a joke about Heidegger being a Nazi, and the simulation of his wife doesn't get it, because he knows his wife would have gotten that joke because she was a philosophy professor and she would know Heidegger. And like, I would never do that in a novel, but when you're thinking like Phil and you're trying to have like, all I was doing in that scene was like, well, how, when I was writing it, was I knew Nick had to not accept this simulation of his wife. And I was like, well, what's a way that he could know that the simulation wasn't up to snuff? And the whole joke about Heidegger like kind of came to me. I was like, well, he should make a joke about a deep cut joke about a philosopher. And that was a very Philip K. Dick thing. And then another one, there's a scene where she's talking to Nick and she's using her inner eye internet, like inside her contact lens, to use predictive text for the conversation. And he tells her, stop using your Convade. And Convade is a name for technology that Phil would use. He loved to take parts of words and shorten them, like people
in the future, a little bit.
Yeah. Like people in the future can't say entire words for things, apparently.
And well, Conapt, right? I think he used that, and that's used in a bunch of other places.
Yeah, Conapt is a perfect example. And then also the inner eye controller was called a ganglion. I would never name something a ganglion, but Phil would. And I didn't even think about that until I was doing the edits the next day. And when I saw ganglion, I literally laughed out loud because I was like, holy shit. Well, and I basically said, hey, Phil, hey, there you are. So
I would have pronounced that ganglion.
Ganglion. Yeah. Ganglion. As the controller, they call it the ganglion.
Like, oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
And also I should note that there's a glossary of terms in the back of the book as well. And one of the fun Easter eggs you can play as a dickhead when you're reading this is, did David invent this word or did Phil? Because some of them, like cephalochromoscope, for example, is straight out of Scanner Darkly. And Conapt is one he used. And so if you're playing along at home and you're like, hey, cephalochromoscope, David did not invent that. Phil invented that. There's also names. There's a lot of the names of characters are recycled names from Philip K. Dick novels, like Mayerson, Nick Mayerson in the novel. Mayerson is the name of one of the characters in Three Stigmata. There's one Runspul. There's characters named Runspul, which is actually a super deep cut, because that comes from mainstream novel called The Man Whose Teeth Were All Exactly Alike, which is the worst title Phil ever had. And most people cannot stand that novel. It's like one of his worst novels ever. And so I got made fun of for making a reference to that. but that's the deep cut of it. And but no, so now I'm interested, Seth, in what you were talking about. Like, what did... Because I'm interested in your reaction to this novel. Of course, I've talked a lot.
Yeah. You were talking about the scene where Nick kind of goes into like a... was it a 24-hour trial?
A 24-hour trial, yeah.
And Kai kind of follows him in, you know, pirates off his thing. And, you know, just like sets a towel down to deal with the fact that she's going to crap her pants while she's in there for 24 hours.
Right.
And I do want to get back to talking about that part as well. But... even though Nick can know that that's not Lisa, that's not really his wife, right? He has a really hard time disconnecting when he comes back out. Mm-hmm. And I found that very affecting, where he had a real hard time remembering what the real world was. And, you know, when he had gone in, before he even went in, he was talking with Kai, you know, because Kai's fervent wish is to get into Great America Plus, right?
Right.
And he says to her, this, again, is a program of engineered sensations, memories of feelings taught to a computer by people.
Right.
And I thought that was a great line.
And
just like, how real could it be? But then you have that character go in it who is skeptical, definitely knows that's not his wife in there, but still is that affected by it.
Right. And thank you for being affected by it. Listen, you cannot do the Philip K. Dick thing if you're not like making your readers question what is real. Mm-hmm. And you have to have your characters really question what is real. And what I really wanted to do there was to make sure that it was hard to leave Great America, that it would be, even for Nick, who's skeptical. I wanted it, especially because one of the things about planet Earth at that point is that it's almost unlivable for humans on the outside. So of course, if you can trick your mind into thinking you're living in a better world, well, why not? And then, and I think about this all the time when thinking about the whole simulation theory is, you know, do you, you know, would I want to live in the simulation? And I think that if you can fool somebody enough, of course you'd want to stay. And I wanted it to be painful for the characters when they leave the simulation. And that's one of the reasons why, like, a lot of the biology and the kind of the body horror of,
I did want to talk about the Cronenberg of it.
And there is a lot of Cronenberg of it. And I actually, this is one of the fun things about my very close dickhead friends having started to read this is even just last night at the PKD hangout, one of the friend of mine from Detroit just finished reading the novel, and he wanted to ask me specifically about that because he thought, and we basically had a whole discussion about that, Phil did like to do that gross stuff sometimes, and he did like to, specifically, I was thinking of Martian Time Slip. Martian Time Slip has a whole thing about the tomb world, that there's a character who's autistic in the novel. And part of the whole horror of Martian Time Slip is this character, he was writing about, he had a friend whose son was autistic, and he had this idea that this kid was just out of joint with time, right? Mm-hmm. And like the kid used to say, there's a character in the novel who just says gubble gubble all the time, and gubble 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 gubble. And one of the horrific things of the novel is there's a scene where you get into this character's head and you realize he understands everything. He's just, everything sped up for him. And they call it in the novel the tomb world. Right. Mm. And it's this really powerful, horrific thing. I wrote about it a lot, and I just recently had an article on Philip K. Dick and horror for Nightmare Magazine. And it's interesting because I wrote about the whole Gubble Gubble Tomb World thing, and I think it's one of the most horrific things Phil ever wrote. And it's not a horror novel. It's just a scene in which is pretty much a science fiction novel. But in relation to Great America, I think Phil, if he was writing about people living in simulation pods, I think he would definitely have written about like the physical goop and shit that was going on about it. And yes,
yeah,
I would.
You could write it very sterile, right? Where you could say they have augments that, you know, just shunt off their colon. And so there's a port, right? rather than being in someone's rectum, right?
I definitely had them in the rectum.
Yeah, you sure did. And when people are in there a long time, right? You got to be careful extracting that. You don't take more than you want to come out.
Right.
You don't want the colon to come with it.
Yeah, when Roger Greenstone's wife comes out of the simulation pod and her Janny like pulls the tube out is pretty much the grossest scene in the book. And it should be noted, I once came in second in the World Horror Gross Out Contest, competing against 14 other horror writers.
Nice.
I was in Portland. By the way, don't let me forget, when we're done with this discussion, we got to talk about the Hillsborough Library. I got to talk to you about your library. But
okay.
Remind me at the end, but as far as like what Great America is doing with that whole body thing is, to me, I wanted to, cause to me, the concept that we live in a simulation is gross, that, you know, and if you're sacrificing your body, I wanted it to be like icky and ooey and gooey. And so, and that might've been a little bit more me, but.
And it draws, a distinction between the idea of this very corporeal Great America thing where you're in the simulation pod and the idea of the transcendent boxing ceremony, right? Where now your body's gone, except for it's a brain in some nutrient solution that keeps it alive effectively forever. And that's very different.
Yeah. And you brought up the boxing ceremony where they, you know, have this whole thing. And one of the things I hope people will realize, one of the things I was going for in this novel, is one of the reasons why Phil is a great science fiction writer to read is that if you read his work, there are just random little world building beats that come out of nowhere that make fantastic points. And it's one of the reasons we're doing the Dickopedia, Philip K. Dick Encyclopedia project. Mm-hmm. And I just finished reading in the last 9 months, I've read all 123 of the short stories that he wrote, and I'm writing all the Dickopedia entries for it. And so believe me, I know every nitty gritty little piece of weird technology or alien outgrowth or whatever that he's done. Mm-hmm. And it was important to me that there are little things throughout the book that just, for example, like, one of the things that I, you know, early on in the outline, I wanted, because Kai, one of the things about Kai is that she makes money by playing video games online. And I didn't think Phil would understand video games very well, but I thought he'd try to make sense of the fact that people play video games online and all that. And I also like the idea that these video games online become this whole other reality. And it would be something that Phil would be interested in, is like this alternate reality. And one of the things about the game that she's playing is it's called Citizen Savior. And I like this idea that that the whole video game is based off mass shootings. And because I wanted in this future for there to be, just like we get a weather report in this future, there's a NRA sponsored like shooter forecast, you know, because to me, one of the most fucked up and horrifying things about our modern world is the fact that, you know, the shootings are so regular that when a bunch of elementary school kids get shot in Connecticut, nobody gives a shit and nobody does anything to change the laws because, you know, that's just America, bud. And
they say now is not the time to talk about this, and there is no time to talk about this.
Right. And if nothing was going to happen after Sandy Hook, then nothing's ever going to happen. And so one of the things, so for example, that's an example of like, I knew it might only be a little bit of world building, but it was something that I was like, okay, I want to make a point about this. I want to make a point about that. And lot of it came naturally, just like in the moment, because Phil used to just throw out these bits of world building and I was trying to kind of do the same thing. And, you know, I definitely feel like this experience has informed the way I do world building in the future for science fiction. And I have to dial some of that back sometimes now, because I'm like, I'm not Phil.
Yeah.
But I'm writing a novella next year that I'm going to let that fly a little bit more than I did. Because the last novel I wrote was the sequel to Last Night to Kill Nazis. And I had to definitely dial back. There's nothing Phil about it. And so I had to kind of unlearn all that stuff for a little bit. And, but actually I like writing with different muscles. So, you know, and that's fun. And everybody should get really excited for the sequel to Last Night to Kill Nazis, because it has U-boats and mummies. And,
oh, sweet.
And let me just say that there's one character in the sequel who's not in the first book who might be my favorite character I've ever written. So nice. Keep your eye out for and I will give away the title. I think it's going to be called The Next Night to Kill Nazis, The Armies of Anubis.
So, oh, cool. Okay.
But it could change.
Yeah, yeah. So back to the boxing ceremony, the religious side of it, right, was really interesting to me. And I remember thinking when I was reading it, you know, it's essentially like a Christian funeral service.
Right.
That then is, you know, is more or less euthanasia, right? Your brain is technically still alive, right? But like, it seems like it's a form of suicide. And I thought, you know, Christians aren't going to be on board with this. And then I'm like, in the last 12 years, Christians have shown us that they will be for anything that certain people say.
Right. And if President Supreme...
If President Supreme says, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that is exactly the thought that I had. I had all those thoughts when I was thinking about, because I wanted it to be like a religious ceremony and that they went to church and did this whole thing. And certainly the fact that evangelicals like will follow a guy who was caught in the Access Hollywood tape was something I wanted to comment on. I definitely wanted to comment on the fact that people will follow him, follow President Supreme, who's never named in the book. He's just President Supreme. Right. You know, that they'll follow him basically to oblivion, was because that's what we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's just magnifying it. As Spinal Tap would say, this one goes to 11. You know, I, you know, was having a lot of fun with that, but you know, the boxing ceremony was definitely like me having a lot of fun with that. And I, you know, it's hilarious because, you know, one of the fun things about this novel was no matter how ridiculous anything got, I was just like, well, I can play with it and have fun with it, because Phil never cared if something sounded ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why his science fiction is so great. And I like the surreal, and he's underrated for his, humor. Definitely wanted it to be funny too. I hope it's funny. I hope people laugh. It's definitely dark and depressing, but you know.
Yeah. It's wistful in places as well, because there's a scene where Kai is flying to DC with Roger and Henry and everybody. And this is kind of Kai's first time leaving the West Coast, far as we know, right? And she's looking out the window and says to, is it Kaylee? It's another character with a K. I think it was Kaylee. It says to her, you know, well, I imagine, you know, everything down there looks different than when you were younger. And Kaylee just kind of says, we only had one world to choose, my dear. It's a pity we didn't choose this one. And there might be more to see down there if we had. And I thought that's exactly right. What's going on now, right? We're looking at the world that we have and deciding not to save it.
Yeah. Did you see that quote from the astronaut who just came back? And he said that he realized after living in on the ISS that we're living a lie, and like how fragile the Earth is. It just taught him that he has to change everything about how he's living. And it's like most people who get up to space realize that. And unfortunately, we don't have enough people. Well, you shouldn't have to go to space to figure that out.
But, right. Right.
You know, but yeah,
it'd be nice if we could put some people into space and bring some of them back.
Yeah. And I appreciate you highlighting that, Seth, because I didn't remember that line. That is definitely a sentiment I feel. So she was definitely speaking for me in that. That's part of the point. I mean, definitely I want people to sit back and be like, oh shit, what are we doing? And you know, that's part of the message. And you know, that's, you know, I think it's hard because science fiction today, like, you know, science fiction has been making these points for over 100 years, since longer than we've had the name for the genre, because we're on year 99 right now. And, that since the genre is named, and, you know, as we come up with the 100th year since the genre was defined, we as a movement, and I'm sure you're very cognizant and aware of science fiction as a movement, having just been at Worldcon like 2 weeks ago, or whatever, you think about it as a movement, and you think about like people like Phil, and you think about people like Ray Bradbury, anybody who, you know, spent their time. We only have so much time on this earth to make a difference, to say something. And for those of us who choose science fiction as an expression of like, you know, hey, stop it, you know, or please change and please be better people. Then we have a responsibility to use this medium responsibly and to express ourselves about, you know, these astronauts who go to space. They come back and they're like, they want to say like, hey, this planet is so fragile, and we have a unique position in this genre that mystery writers don't have or romance writers don't have, is that we can look at things globally and act locally, right? So, you know, and it's not to say that every piece of science fiction, I still wrote a vampire Nazi, a vampire killing Nazis novels. It's not to say that, I mean, there's important points and messages in that one too.
Yeah.
Like fuck Nazis, which unfortunately is a message that needs to be heard more often now.
Yeah.
And, but you know, you think about the responsibility that we have as creators, like to say something, and, you know, yeah, I wanted to do the experiment and the formula and do all that, and that was fun. But, you know, you know, the message in the end is the thing that I'm going to feel real good about, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've had a couple people who've read this say to me that the book hit them really hard. And I appreciate that. Because I do think that's a huge part of it. There is both a positive ending and a negative ending to this book for specific reasons. And there's ways to come out of it feeling hopeful, and there's ways to come out of it feeling bad. But most importantly, Seth, and I can't believe we've been talking for over an hour and I haven't said this, but the main point that I wanted to make when I sat down to write this, and we're an hour and 5 minutes in and I hadn't said this, but the main point when I sat down to write this, I looked at our world and I said, MAGA lives in one reality. We live in another reality. We live in two separate realities. And how can I make a point about these two tribes of humans who live on the same planet but don't inhabit the same reality? Because, you know, look, I play basketball with most of the people are politically aligned with me at basketball, but there's one like super crazy MAGA dude that I play basketball with. And I've tried talking with him a few times, and it's just like, we're just not living on the same, like, we just don't see the world the same way. And
yeah.
So the bipartisanship, and I wrote a science fiction novel that's not Phil at all, that I haven't figured out how to find a home for, but I wrote a science fiction novel in 2020 called Not Alone. And that whole novel is completely about partisanship as well, but it's a first contact novel. And hopefully I'm going to be trying to find a home for that novel soon. That novel is also about bipartisanship. And what the crazy thing is that I don't know if everyone's going to get it, but Great American Dead World is a novel entirely about bipartisanship and how we live in our own silos and of reality. And I thought, what is more Philip K. Dick than exploring the fact that these two segments of society live in completely different realms of belief and reality. And I'm very proud of how the novel rips off that Band-Aid. I don't know that everyone will understand it, but that is what I was trying to do.
And like I said, I got to that part and I was like, but I definitely missed something and had to, you know, I kind of finished the chapter and went back. I'm like, okay, what's happening? I read it. I think I read it two or three times. And then like, I was like, oh, I see what he did here. Okay. Very smart. I like it.
And that is the ending where my editor was like, I'm not sure this fits. And I said, well, that's the whole point, because Phil used to write endings that sometimes seemed like totally out of nowhere. And like, Scanner Darkly is a prime example. There's 20 pages after it should have ended. And it goes into some really weird stuff. And so I wanted to do that. And so that I had originally written a short story about a future America where liberals and conservatives lived in actual different planes of reality, and they only met on the floor of Congress. And so I just decided to put that at the end of this novel instead of doing it as a short story, and kind of shoehorn the characters in, and because that's the kind of thing Phil would do all the time. He would repurpose short stories all the time, and so there's a lot of short stories that would later become novels because he would just be like, "I'm going to turn this into a novel," and for that, you know. Well, and it's fine. It's proper to read it and then go back and be like, oh, hey, maybe I missed that. And, you know, and it's the fun of it all. And, you know, and Seth, by the way, and I really appreciate, because I know how because I listen to your podcast, I know what your reading time is like and how busy it is. So the fact that you took the time to read this and do this with me really means a lot to me. And I hope that your listeners, I doubt many of them made it this far, but if they did, I hope that my hope is that they paused it a long time ago, said, I'm going to go read this book and then I'll come back and listen to it. Maybe they'll make it this far. And that being said, before I forget, you use the Hillsborough Library, right? That's your library.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a librarian there named Ian Duncanson. One of my oldest buddies. You will freak him out if you go in there and just like, if you see Ian on a name tag, or he's a youth librarian, I think. But if you call, he's like, hey, Brew Dog. He'll lose his mind. That's his nickname. But, and you can see him. He's in the documentary from the fake documentary we made for my novel, Punk Rock Ghost Story. Cause he's he is a massive record collector, but he's in there as Ian Brewdog, but he's in the documentary. But anyways, he's a librarian at Hillsborough. He has been for like 12 years. So,
awesome.
You mentioned the Hillsborough Library on your podcast. I was listening to your Dean Koontz one, and you mentioned it, and I was like, oh yeah, I got to remember to tell him.
You freak
him out. Just be like, Bruda.
Afterwards, I'll have to ask you which branch he's at, because there's more than one branch.
That's true. Well, I know he gets right off the Max and goes right there. So there's one that's right by the Max, right?
Okay. That's the one closest to my house.
See, I think that's him. But he's okay. a youth librarian. But he's been on the podcast before. He's some people will know he did the Canticle for Leibowitz episode with me and Brian Evanson on Dickheads. So,
oh, cool. I've listened to that one. So,
yeah. He's a Hillsborough librarian. But yeah, I appreciate the chance to talk about this, and I really am super proud of this novel. I don't know that it's perfect, but I feel real like that it did a lot of the things I wanted to do. So, mm-hmm.
Well, and I'll tell people it's not a tome either, right? It's a brisk novel.
Yeah. As Phil would say, he wrote 55,000 words because that was the length that was required of him at the time in publishing. You know, you wanted to do an ace paperback, you had to get 55,000 words. And mm-hmm. So it's short. It's only 56,000 words. And then it has a glossary and the essay, which mm-hmm. explains. And I had somebody recently reach out to me that they actually wanted to teach this novel for a creative process class because the essay is such a, not only does it explain how I wrote this novel, but it also explains how Philip K. Dick wrote a novel. So, mm-hmm. And I was really, so it actually may get used as a, teaching method at a class at USC.
Cool.
It's a professor at USC, Nikita, who teaches Soviet science fiction. And he's a regular in our PKD hangout. And and also, I should say that I am doing a lecture on PKD and artificial humans and empathy at the Science Fiction Across Media Conference in LA coming up, and I do want to shout out that conference because it's mostly academics, but there's academics from all over the world, and I would like more science fiction people to know about this conference that happens every fall in LA. So if you don't make it this year, Ted Chiang is going to be the keynote speaker this year, and Gail Ann Hurd, who co-wrote Terminator and mm-hmm. Aliens, is going to be one of the guest speakers. And it's a really great conference, and it's not really known outside of academics, and I really want to spread the word on that. And I should also note that next year, if you're going to Worldcon, which is going to be in Anaheim, California, close mm-hmm. to where Phil lived, that the week before Worldcon, we are doing the Philip K. Dick Festival in Orange County, 1 week before Worldcon at Fullerton University, and we're going to be setting up a pop-up science fiction artifact museum at Fullerton that will be open both weekends. So
very cool.
It'll be open during PKD Fest and during Worldcon, and you can come to Fullerton and check out, there's going to be the original manuscripts of four of the Dune novels, and sorry about the dog. So if you want to see the original straight from the typewriter, red penned manuscript of Dune, it's there. It'll be there. We're going to have manuscripts. We're going to have zines from back in the day and other collectibles as a pop-up museum. But the whole PKD Fest is going to be 1 week before Worldcon. So I'm highly recommending to people, if you want to make a 2 week vacation out of Los Angeles. This is my wife's subtle way of trying to get me to end the interview by putting the dog in here. If you want to make a whole trip out of it and do other Southern California things between the two cons, we're going to be doing that 1 week before Worldcon. So it'll be a really great way to do both. And PKD Fest, if all goes as planned, we're going to have like a bus tour of PKD, like places he lived, apartments he lived, places he wrote about in Orange County. And we're going to have academic speakers. We're going to have live readings of PKD plays and screenplays. We're going to have a short story contest, a screenplay contest that you can join and win a Pink Beam Award. We're going to be giving away, and we're going to have guests of honor speakers, academic talks, all mostly Philip K. Dick related, but some other science fiction writers. And if all goes as planned, I am trying to and working on doing a screening of Blade Runner inside the Bradbury building as the closing cool. event in LA. And if you don't know, that's the building where a lot of the funky noir shots in Blade Runner were filmed. And so if all goes as planned, that will end with that screening, but it's going to be a really cool weekend, and I'm hoping Tim Powers is actually the one narrating the bus tour. So for those who are nice. Fans of as Phil called him Powers, he never called him Tim, he called him Powers. So it's funny because we always want to just call him Powers because Phil did, and we think that's cool. And just like he called I tried when I interviewed Norman Spinrad, I tried calling him Spinny because Phil called him Spinny, and he gave me a very dirty look. So I did not do that after that. I was like, okay, only Phil gets to call him Spinny.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, so if people have listened this far and they want to get a copy of the book, how do they go about doing that?
Well, my favorite place to send them to is bookshop.org or Barnes & Noble's website. Okay. I'm pro Barnes & Noble's for a couple reasons. One, they've started empowering local stores to do their own book buying, and I think that's great. Also, they carry my novel, The Last Night to Kill Nazis, on the shelves nationally. So I like that about Barnes & Noble. So I appreciate that, and they can go there. But you can buy it on Amazon if you need to. Definitely do that. And, I have another novel from Quire, called People's Park, which is not written with the formula, but it is PKD inspired, but it's a punk rock coming of age novel. So I would say that if you're going to buy two, picking up Great America and People's Park is a good combo.
Okay. So, nice.
But you know, I'm always, and then you can always find Dickhead's podcast on Tuesday nights. You can join us for the live discussions. We are going to have Ken Liu coming up in October to talk about his new novel. It's a big one.
Cool.
We're going to have, Ai Jiang coming on to talk about her recent story in Clark's World coming up. Sylvia Park talking about Luminous. So we have all kinds of really great guests all the time. And then sometimes we'll just have like people who like, I hung out and smoked weed with Phil. And we've also had a lot of the kids. Sean Goulart's coming on soon. We had Seth Davis, son of Grania Davis and Avram Davidson. You know, we've had Ray Nelson's son came on. So we've had children of a lot of the big science fiction writers on, which has been really fun too. And so we do fun stuff there on Tuesday nights. And so I definitely recommend people come by and hang out. Sometimes it's really nerdy discussions. If you're not like a super hardcore film nerd, you might not want to hang for the second hour. but the first hour is usually the guest and the second hour is the nerd out. And the nerd out is usually just us like, hey, what am I working on? What am I researching? Oh, I read this story this week and let's talk about it. And then, and I have a personal podcast, Postcards from a Dying World. You've been on several times, Seth. And I'm probably going to have you back for the Science Fiction Hall of Fame again. At some point, cool. I'm getting back to that series. So please, check out that stuff. But if you're going to do one thing, picking up this book, Great America and Dead World, is the thing that I really hope people do.
Awesome. Well, I hope a bunch of people do. I hope a bunch of people listen to this and pick up the book because I thought it was terrific. So, and David, it had been too long. It's really great to chat with you.
Yeah, when you get back from England, how long are you in England for?
A couple weeks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When you get back from England, we'll have to do something Science Fiction Hall of Fame related. And
sounds good.
I only make you read a short story. So.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Bye now.